Everyone, I'm comedian Wyatt Cenac. Please feel free to check out my HBO show, Wyatt Cenac's Problem Areas. It's available on YouTube. It might be geo-blocked, which that's not my fault. That is some fault between HBO and YouTube. So please direct your comments to them.
Judging from your clock behind you, you are in New York, right?
Yes, or I just gave up on telling time with the pandemic. It's really either or.
You know, they say even a broken clock is right once a day. So
twice a day.
Twice a day.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it'll work. Yeah. Where are you right now?
Johannesburg.
Okay. Yes. I didn't realize you were in South Africa. How is everything there? How are all doing with this pandemic?
We're doing well. We've just discovered a week ago that we've got a brand new strain of COVID that we're importing to the world. I mean, exporting to the world. So we're very happy about that.
Yeah, congrats. this is the maker economy right now. And you make whatever, whether that's something on Etsy or some COVID. You gotta be a maker these days.
You know what I find strange? In the week before it was announced that we will be getting the vaccine, it was also announced a week later that we have a different strain of coronavirus, which makes me wonder, why are we being told that just after we've been told that we're getting a vaccine? This thing is never going to end. I feel like it's going to be a Russian roulette and a Ferris wheel of bullshit where you cure one and then the other one starts, and you cure one and the other one starts. And I can tell you from my theory, I think it all started when they said the vaccine is 94 or 95% certain. And I'm like, what about the 5%? What is that 5% that we're not being told about?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how news coverage is out there, but I wish they did a better job of just talking all of us through this, because I saw there was an article where they were talking about the vaccine. And one of the things that was the most fascinating to me was the idea that they'd figured it out like pretty quick. Like, you know, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, there's a coronavirus, and then scientists are there, like, and they're like, okay, yeah, this is the DNA strand that we need to take, and we do this, and that happens pretty quick. And then everything else is like, okay, now we're just testing it and we're doing all these things. But the way that I feel like the way the news media, and I think specifically the administration here in the US presented everything, it felt like it was this secret code that people were trying to like crack. And it was like, oh no, it's taken months and months and months. And it's like, nah, they got it. They just have to go through the scientific steps with it. And maybe if every week you were talking about that, as opposed to like just like letting people sort of believe what this administration is saying, as far as like, oh, these people are close. They're really close to figuring it out. It's I feel like that would at least help people see and know what's going on in a way that maybe now we're not in like a second, like we're not just in a second surge of a pandemic, we're also in a second surge of panic.
You know, I you're absolutely right, but
thank what you've you. Just that's ex- all I came here for.
What
we're done, right? You told me I'm right, and yeah, goodbye. Sorry, I interrupted you.
What you've just explained is proves the same theory that people have been saying, that COVID is not a new virus. So it just needed the right recording company and the right promotion. And it went on tour, and then it started selling a lot of tickets, and then they had to hype it up, right? Started doing interviews. Yeah. People were talking about it, you know, and then the vaccine is the album dropping, because the introduction to the product, it was just COVID. Right. So COVID-19, coronavirus in the year 2019.
Right.
Right. And then it hit us hard in 2020. So it was introduced to us. It did a press junket in 2019. And then it started doing a tour in the whole of 2020, right?
Right, yeah.
Then now it's like releasing a second album and a video here and there. I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. COVID is the Lady Gaga of diseases. It's going to keep reinventing itself.
Well, the one thing you hope is that it reinvents itself. I mean, I guess it's like, to your point, it's coronaviruses have existed
yes.
for a very long time. And again, it goes to that idea that we don't talk about these things enough. Like there's, you know, there's just not enough of this in conversation when you're talking about news or whatever, that like, if we were discussing this regularly, like, okay, well, the next coronavirus strain has mutated
and
people should, you know, keep getting those flu vaccines, but also this strain seems to be a little more lethal than the previous strain. Let's go back and look at like SARS-CoV-2 and compare these things. Like, these are all from the same family of shit.
Yes.
And if we'd been talking about it like that, it feels like you could, one, be able to track these things and we could be ahead of these things rather than like get caught with our pants down on them. But also, it is to your point, like it's not going anywhere. The best hope and the, you know, what it feels like the reality is when you compare it to something like the, you know, the 1918 flu is that we will build up immunity to it. It will weaken and weaken itself as it mutates and as it kind of like, you know, as people get vaccinated, it will just become a version of a common flu bug or something like that. That, in like 5 years, someone will be like, oh yeah, I got COVID and I still like, you know, Kevin Durant will have the COVID game or something like that.
You know, I think since the invention of the pharmaceutical industry, they've always needed a mascot for everything that they're doing, right? So I think this is one that's going to carry them for the longest of time, because I think people were getting used to AIDS.
Yeah.
You know, it went from a handful of pills shoved down your throat 5-15 times a day to just one pill a day.
Right.
And then, you know, so they were losing traction with that. You know, cancer, same thing. You know, you go to radiation and you take a medication here and there. So people started getting used to that. But COVID is almost like the AIDS of the mouth. It's almost like, because when you think of AIDS, right? It became a moral disease more than a genetic disease. Or a disease that affects your genetics, right? So people started going, you could have gotten just one way. You fucked somebody. Right. And people were like, no, could be through a blood transfusion. Then they said, no. Then you have a fucked up doctor. Then you go, no. Or you're born with it. Or you could have done something. So coronavirus is the same. But when it starts affecting old people and people that are contributing to the economy and people of a higher class that can't fight it, then it became everyone's problem. But for the longest of time, TB and AIDS and some other genetic diseases became other people's problems. This is the first time where this is our problem.
Well, and it's, I mean, even when you think about something like SARS, that was not, you know, that was not an American problem as Americans, you know, as we as Americans saw it. It was not our thing. And I feel like so many of the, you know, it was like, oh, this is a terrible thing that's happening and we'll come in and fix it, because as America, we feel that's what we, like, we're going to be the ones who fix things. But this is a you problem. And this is, you know, and I feel like there's so much of, even when you look at diseases that, especially diseases that exist outside the U.S. at a, you know, at a higher rate, mortality rate, death rate, they become very racialized. They become very much like, oh, that's an Africa problem. The continent of Africa has a higher, you know, has higher cases of, you know, this particular illness or disease. It's an Africa problem.
Yes.
And it's, you know, or it's an Asian problem. It is not an American problem.
Yes.
And that feels like that is the great failing of both the United States wanting to place itself as the leader of the free world without actually engaging with the free world, whether that's educationally knowing what's going on outside the US, or just from a humanitarian standpoint, being genuinely involved in what is happening globally, whether that's pulling out of something like the Paris Climate Accords.
Absolutely.
Or just trade, and the fact that, okay, you will, you know, as a country, we can sit there and take resources from countries left and right, and, you know, we'll say, oh yeah, we will back any company that wants to, you know, put a highway through the Serengeti to get cell phone parts to people, without regard for what that does to that actual, to those people, the flora, the fauna, the community that exists there. We do not think about those things. And so that feels like that is the great hypocrisy of like, no, we want to be the leader of the free world, but we don't actually want to engage with anyone who's outside of our border.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the world politics and the care for illnesses that out there needed a crossover artist, you know? So COVID became the M&M of it. Because if you think of Ebola, right? Ebola kills you 100%. There's no surviving Ebola. You don't walk out of Ebola with a cup of Starbucks in your hand, right, and a chai and a pumpkin spice latte. You die. Once you get Ebola, it's game over for you. Right. Even the care workers that provide, the doctors that provide care for people with Ebola, knew that's the risk they're taking every time they took care of the patients. But COVID has a survival rate much higher than the mortality rate, right? So when it stopped the grinding wheels of the first world economies, that's when it became everyone's problem. And you're absolutely right. You know, it offended people's pockets.
Yes. Yeah.
And in its offense, it lined more pockets. So it was the gift that kept on giving. It was.
Yeah. But what's weird is just even what you were saying earlier about the way in which pharmaceutical companies try to monetize these things, you would think that it would be in their best interest to not simply be in the like emergency care business, but to be in the preventative care business. And if they're so much in the preventative care business, it seems like it would be the smart thing to do to say, we want to educate a public, and we want to educate a public about these particular types of things that are going on, that like, okay, you don't just want cancer medicine.
Yes.
You know, like, yeah, you got cancer. Okay, now here's cancer medicine. But also thinking about the front end of these things, that like, yeah, viruses change. There is the flu. Get a flu shot. Like those, and it doesn't really seem like those are conversations that they're as interested in having.
Of course they can't, because remember that whenever there's a pandemic, there's also panic. And when there's panic, the person with the solution calls the shots in determining what the price of the solution is.
Right.
So once the World Health Organization gets involved and the UN gets involved, and then they kind of tell the whole world that if someone charges you £15 million or $15 million for an injection, it's okay. So if they certified from the top and said, that's fine, that's the NFL of the, you know, of the whole entire thing. It's like, we're determining the price. This is our first draft. We're going with this person.
Right.
I mean, that's how it happened. So once governments of the world, right? Once they take medical care and pharmaceutical companies and nationalize them instead of privatizing them, that's when you will care about preventing diseases, right? No. But for now, the money is in the cure. The money is in the delayed effects of anything that's wrong with you.
Right. Yeah. What is it? It's penicillin. I feel like penicillin is like the sort of great example of what you're talking about, of like nationalizing versus privatizing, in that when penicillin was created, it was just like, oh, okay, yeah, here's this thing, penicillin, and here's the recipe. And it was just kind of like, oh yeah, everyone can have access to this thing. And now it's like, oh no, I've figured this thing out, and I'm gonna charge you for it, and you know, hopefully, I'm gonna get rich like Martin Shkreli.
Who's Martin Shkreli?
Oh, you don't know who Martin Shkreli is?
Tell me about him. He sounds like a guy I need to know about. Am I gonna hate him?
Yes. Oh yeah.
Tell me about him then.
He is a guy who, he started. He had like a pharmaceutical, I guess a pharmaceutical company. Basically, he was buying up patents, and so owning these pharmaceutical patents meant that if you wanted to make a drug, you had to go through him, and he started charging exorbitant prices, and just, it was like a huge, like, price, is it price gouging? Like, he was just like setting these high prices for these drugs that were like drugs that a small number of the population needed, but because it's such a small number of the population, he can charge, like, no one else is producing this stuff, and so he's charging like crazy amounts, and he's now he's in prison for everything he was doing. But it was this thing where he became the face of this sort of movement of pharmaceutical capitalism. And at the height of his power, he, Wu-Tang made this album. Remember, they made a record where they like charged, they only made one copy and they charged like like $100,000 or something like that for it. Do you remember this story? Wu-Tang made an album and they were like, they charged some crazy price and it was just one record. And this guy bought it. And then when Wu-Tang found out, like, Ghostface was just like posting videos of just like, fuck that, Martin Shkreli can't have this album. And it was a very weird thing where you saw like Ghostface, the pharmaceutical industry, and like it's all kind of like coming together in this weird, oh yeah, if you had this as your, like, in your office pool of like things that were going to be together, Ghostface Killer, the pharmaceutical industry, Martin Shkreli, like, it all just kind of came together in this really bizarre way.
What you've explained about Martin Shkreli to me sounds like Microsoft Windows.
I have not used Microsoft Windows in forever.
He cornered the market. He was the only one selling it, and he could charge whatever he likes for it, right?
Yeah. Hold on. I'm going to just so I can be totally clear here. Yes. Yeah. So he's currently serving 7 years. He was called the Pharma Bro. He was a former hedge fund manager, now convicted felon. And he was widely criticized when his company obtained the manufacturing license for the anti-parasitic drug Daraprim, and he raised its price by a factor of 56 from $13.50 per pill to $750 per pill.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Jesus. That's horrible.
It's horrible. And what's crazy is there was like this Netflix show, a docuseries that this guy Alex Gibney made. And he did one episode on Martin Shkreli and basically was like, Martin Shkreli is the small fish in this pond. And then the episode is just breaking down like, oh yeah, you thought this guy was bad. Here's more of these, and they still exist, and they're not in jail for securities fraud or anything like that. And it's just like, yeah, that all needs to change.
I still think pharmaceuticals is a big scam. You think of when aspirin was made, it was made decades ago, almost half a century ago, right? And we still use it today. There hasn't been anything better than aspirin. You think of saline sprays, which is just basically water with some salt in it to flush down whatever is going down in your nostrils, right, whenever you have a blocked nose. So these little paracetamol, and you think of, like you said, birth control, nothing much has changed. in the core and penicillin. And so nothing much has changed the core of what human body needs, right? To stay healthy long enough for something else to happen to it so that it can survive it again and again and again. And the mutation of the human DNA strand is so complex that even scientists themselves haven't figured it out. Because everything else would have been cured by now. You know, we would be living in a world where you cannot have a headache. You cannot have a blocked nose. We still can't cure sneezes. Flu has been evolving since the day of the flu. You know, the last time flu had a hit was with the Spanish flu. And now it came back again as something else now. So we are not going to get off.
Bird flu did okay for itself. Yeah. Swine flu. People still talk swine flu.
Swine flu was very divisive because Jewish people and Muslim people did not take it seriously. They were like, we don't eat pig, so we're fine. They're like, it's not because you ate pork that you are going to get swine flu, because swine is pork, right?
It's a weird thing. I feel like, again, in thinking about the conversations we have around this stuff, it's how we talk about these things that it's like, oh yeah, just call it, you know, coronavirus. Like, we don't need, like, just call it what it is. Like, it's weird when people are like, well, it originated in a bird, so we'll call it bird flu. And it's like, no, like, let's just get used to the scientific terms. We don't need to pretty this up in any way. Like,
but there must be a think tank at pharmaceutical companies to name these things, right? Because you think of remember the foot and mouth disease?
Oh yes, hoof and mouth.
Exactly. And then there was the mad cow disease.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Again, like, I feel like you're coming up with these names and it's just like, nah, just like call it, you know, whatever its real name is. Like, let's just get used to that. And then, because, yeah, I think it does, like, I mean, I feel like I remember with mad cow, there was this real sense of, like, panic as far as, oh, can you eat ground beef, or can you eat, like, and no one's actually talking about the part of it of, like, well, where's your meat coming from? And, like, maybe we should be talking about, like, factory farming versus, and, like, the, you know, sanitary nature of factory farms versus, you know, smaller farms. And but that's, you know, that's a bigger conversation. That's, we're talking flu. That's a larger conversation about produce and our food economy.
Absolutely. And I haven't seen one mad cow. I haven't seen one video. I've seen cats playing the piano. I've seen little monkeys riding pigs on the internet, but I've never seen one mad cow. And there was a whole entire marketing strategy behind saying there is the mad cow disease. So what did the cows do when they had this disease? Did anyone ever find out? Is there Wikipedia link somewhere I can follow?
I feel like there probably is. I feel like it was a thing. It was like a degenerative thing for the cows. I've seen a mad turkey.
What happened?
The internet is filled with videos of, like, turkeys are really aggressive. It's kind of a surprise that we eat them the way that we do here in the US, because they're incredibly aggressive. There was this video that I saw. It was like a few years ago, and it was like a little kid with a backpack running for their life being chased by a turkey. And eventually a car had to just, like, pull in front of the turkey to just, like, block it so the kid could run away safely.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a very strange, let me see. I'll see if I can find it. Good. As I'm doing this, my computer just showed me I could watch live analysis right now as the Republican Party in the United States is trying to overturn an election.
In the election, in Georgia or in the whole country?
Right now, they're trying to overturn the whole country.
Right? The whole country.
Yeah, they're, let's see. Okay, hold on. I'm, let me get back to Zoom here and I'm going to share the screen. Oh, you won't let me share the screen. I was going to share the screen and show you this.
Crazy turkey chasing a kid.
Yeah, but it says,
I'm more interested now in the overturning of the elections in your country right now. What is going on there, Wyatt? Is it 50-50 for the Democrats in general when you walk down the streets and when you look at the polls or the results after people have voted, right? Is it 50-50? Is half of your country going, we want to be Republican? Is the other country, half of the country going, we just want to stay Democrat? Or is there an overwhelming number of people on either side?
I don't know that it's that binary of a thing. I think that we have created a binary choice that you either have to be a Republican or you have to be a Democrat as far as political party. But the reality is, I think most people in this country actually have more interests and values that would put them in the category of being in the Democratic Party than in the Republican Party. Like, I feel like there's enough, like, you see enough of it where people will talk about, like, you know, things like Medicare. Like, for most, like, I would say middle class, maybe even upper middle class and below, most of the things that people want, they will talk about, like, you know, infrastructural things they want. They will talk about healthcare things they want. They'll talk about educational things they want. And they're all things that theoretically are aligned with a less capitalistic driven political approach. What I feel like this country has done is, by making it a binary choice, you're not really picking the things you're interested in. You're just picking a color you like.
Yes.
And so it just happens that, like, well, if you like blue, then you're the Democratic Party. If you like red, yes, you're in the Republican Party. And it's really been more about that, because I think the thing, like, when you see polls and people talk about, like, you know, healthcare, you know, universal healthcare, most people will say, oh yeah, I hate the current healthcare system. I would love a single payer thing that would exist. You have, like, overwhelming support for things like that. The reality of, like, doing it, though, if you, like, you have people who will be in the, you know, who are in the Republican Party, who will say that they voted for Trump and also say they want single payer healthcare or they want some sort of universal healthcare. They don't want it called Obamacare,
yes,
which gets to a, you know, an underlying racism that this country needs to reckon with. But I remember during the Obama administration, there were polls that were done where they asked people about the Affordable Care Act, and then they asked them about Obamacare.
Mm.
And there were people who were like, I love the idea of the Affordable Care Act. And then when they were told, what do you think about Obamacare? They were like, oh no, fuck no. And it's just like, they're just saying no on
the name itself.
Yeah, again, on color. It's not red and blue, it's black and white, but it is this, it's these binary choices have kind of, like, gotten in the way of people actually being focused on, well, what are the things that you actually give a shit about? And those are the things that, okay, yeah, that's not putting you in a party, that's putting you in this, like, you want healthcare. Let's get all the healthcare people together and let's make that happen. And so I think, I feel like this country would probably devolve into chaos if it had a multi-party system. But I also think after, like, a few years of chaos, things would probably normalize in a way that might be better than what it currently is.
I think whenever I watch presidential debates in your country, and I'm no expert in American politics at all, but I almost want to compare it to a family reunion that happens once a year, but now has to cater for a vegan backyard cousin that lives very far away from you, and then just disrupts everyone just because they don't want to eat meat tonight. And yeah. Everyone is like, but most of us are having meat. Then you're like, nope, I decide I don't eat meat anymore. Then that cousin happens to be the one that tells everyone that this is not cool anymore, you know, because your issues are so broad and everyone in their little states has their own problems. People are talking about gun control. Some people over here in the state are talking about Black Lives Matters and the impact that it has on that community specifically. But in some parts, people don't really care about that, you know? So I feel like you guys have all of that. Where else in our country, the campaign is very simple every year. Do you want white people back in power or not? And then as black people, we go, we don't think so. We're not ready. Then whatever politics you guys have in the middle of that package, we'll take it. You know, we don't have to like it. But the question for us is always simple, Wyatt. We will never see a white president in this country ever again.
I think for the difference, one of the big differences is though, like you're like, as you're talking about a country like the United States, in truth, the United States is 50 countries that are just kind of like have gotten together in a, you know, pre-Brexit kind of a situation. Yes. And they haven't, like, one, they've never lived as independent countries.
Yes.
And so there's a part of it that's like, oh, if they did, then all of a sudden things would be very different, because all of a sudden you'd have a lot of states that have relied on federal assistance. Like many of the Republican states rely on a great deal of federal assistance, yet will be the first to be like, oh, we don't want the federal government in our, you know, in our world and in our lives. And like, they'll rail against like federal government, but it's like, well, but wait a minute, you as a state don't make enough, like you don't produce enough as a state to just run your state. It's other states that are like putting money in the pot to help you so that you can do a poor job of educating people.
So you basically, you're the vegan cousin that didn't bring anything to the barbecue, but demands a vegan party.
But I would say in your analogy, you said it was like a family reunion. I would say it's like a family reunion, but it's like a family reunion where it's, you have a married couple and both of their families have come together for this family reunion. And so it is this idea that like, it's not simply one person, but it's, you have two families here who are like, well, usually we have potato salad. And it's like, no, we're coleslaw people. And so then even within the thing, you got a rando cousin who's just like coming over and moving the potato salad off the table and making room for Nana Butterworth's coleslaw. And it's like, no, what are you doing? Like, and it's this, and so you have like, it's not simply there's one agitator, you have like a family of it, because they're both, you have both families trying to figure out like, okay, now's the time we do the electric slide. And it's like, nope, that's not a thing this family does. That's not family reunion. And
and they've got enough people to agree with them. I get your point there. It's not a random renegade cousin who's just bumped into veganism, right? It's just the whole entire side of the family that believes and feels the same way.
Yeah. Or just then entrenches themselves in, you know, even if they don't fully believe in veganism, that it's like, oh, well, you have this one, you know, you have this one cousin who's just said this thing, and just reflexively they get defensive on behalf of that cousin. And then it's like, okay, we're all in, and we're all like, as a family, we're all like, fuck that other family. And then the problem is you still have this married couple that are just like trying to, you know, it was like, we just thought it was a good idea to have a joint family reunion. And now we're realizing it is tearing this family apart.
So now you guys have a well-established, well-rounded new father of the nation that's coming in, Joe Biden, right? I always wonder to myself, is he looking cool to us all, the world, the Americans now, before he gets into that White House and stands behind that pulpit that has the insignia of the country and he has to tell us some bad news? Because I feel like there's something about being behind that pulpit that just makes you look at someone and go, you're just like one of them, aren't you? You know, at which point is he going to look like an elderly, rich, white man still in control of America?
I mean, he still looks like that to me. He's never stopped looking like that. And he still is a politician. He still looks like a politician. To me, what I feel like will be successful in his presidency, if he's successful, I think it's going to be if the conversation can get back to politics and to actual like civic engagement with the public. And so that to me feels like, okay, that would be successful, but he's a politician. He's still, you know, as much as I would love on day one for him to say like, okay, let's reform the election process and get that taken care of so that we don't have another fucking crazy rat show like we have right now. And as much as I'm like, oh, I hope he does that, I know that's not going to happen. Like I have a low bar that he's going to be like, yeah, the Electoral College is actually a very stupid remnant of slavery, and it doesn't actually benefit it doesn't benefit the democracy in the way that we think it does, because it just kind of like shifts things where, you know, a white voter in a rural state has more power than a voter of color in, you know, sometimes in that same state and sometimes even outside that state. And so it just feels like, oh, I'd love for him to get rid of that. I don't think it's going to happen. Even if, you know, right now we're trying to figure out if the Senate control will go to the Democratic Party. As much as I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, day one, just start pushing shit through, I know that's not going to happen.
Where do black people see Kamala Harris in all of this? Do they see her as the auntie that lives in the big house, that sneaks us some alcohol once in a while and gives us $100 note to go party and gives us the key when we get back late at night?
Right.
Or is it going to be the auntie that just tells the older white gentleman that this is not how shit should be, man. Let's just do it right.
Yeah, I don't know. I honestly don't know. Because throughout history, I feel like I don't know what a vice president has really done. Like, this is the first, I can say that this Trump administration is the first time where I've seen like a vice president like step forward and was like, oh, Vice President Pence is the one in charge of the coronavirus task force. And it's like, okay, that's what you did as second president. Nice work. You really fucked that one up. But I feel like vice presidents in general, they're kind of like seen and not heard. And so I think there's a part of this that, for as historic as Kamala Harris's role now as vice president is, I do wonder if it's going to be a thing where she's just going to be there and we'll see her, you know, in the opportunities when we see her, like, as sort of public appearances, but will she be out there in a visible way where we see her actually getting to govern and do things? And that's, I hope so. But I also, yeah, I also don't know. I mean, she's, you know, she also is a career politician. And so I don't know as far as like what her, you know, what her agenda is when it comes to something like criminal justice reform. Her track record on it hasn't always been one that has been in favor of people over police. Oh, I just lost you. I lost your audio.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
I was saying, in your country, there's only but two presidents for me, vice presidents that have ever stuck out in history. One was, I think, Truman after FDR. And for me, he sticks out because he inherited the Manhattan Project. And he basically was surrounded by voices that just wanted the atomic bomb to be dropped in Hiroshima. Right. And he did it, right? And the guilt on that was tremendous. So when we look at lives lost during World War II, we go, there was that side of Europe, and then there was Nagasaki and Hiroshima, right? So those are the, yeah. That's one president that for me sticks out. The other one that sticks out is after Kennedy died.
LBJ.
Right? Yes. Lyndon Johnson, right? So yes, I'm yes, like,
sorry, Lyndon Johnson.
Lyndon Johnson. So he took over the most beloved. So these are the two men that took over the most beloved president. I mean, FDR ran four terms uncontested. You know, he landslide throughout four terms, right?
Right.
And then Kennedy was very beloved. So he was probably going to win if he ran again.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, I don't know. I feel like there's been some conversation about what perception and reality were,
yes,
with Kennedy, okay, in the moment during his, yes, presidency. I think,
yes,
I think, you know, death has given him a certain amount of grace, and but I think during, there was obviously like, oh, he's this very handsome guy that people see as kind of like an aspirational idea of what a president is.
He was handsome compared to Nixon.
Yes. Yeah. yeah. It's
the bar was very low.
Yeah. But Nixon had better calf muscles. That was the thing. Nixon, every day was leg day for Nixon. That's one of those things that, you know, historians don't really get into, but yeah, Nixon was a big, like, under the Resolute desk where the president sits, he had those little weights that you tie to your ankles, those little ankle weights. He's always doing little calf raises under there. Yeah. Oh, he, that was his one regret, I think, more than the Watergate. His one regret was not wearing enough shorts. He was like, I should have worn more shorts. I should have shown off these calves, maybe even show off a little thigh. Oh, I'd, there's no way they would have impeached these gams.
You know, it's so much fun to talk to someone interesting. And I think with us, and you'd know this is a comic, we speak to so many people, but mostly we're the interesting people in the conversation. You know, when we leave the conversation, we're like, I did so much for this. I basically carried this conversation in my shoulders and I didn't need to do that. And then you leave and then you feel so robbed and you feel like, you know, you feel like you're doing the walk of shame. And it's rare that you talk to someone and you're like, yeah, I feel like I had fun. Someone carried me here.
Oh, thank you. No, I had fun as well. To what you were saying though, I always worry if I'm in a group conversation, I leave, that people are like, oh, thank God he's gone. Now, now we can relax. Now we can really just kind of like, we can talk about what we want to talk about.